well in your life. You're walking in obedience. You are being faithful in your worship. You're faithful in public worship. You're faithful in private worship. You are faithful to your wife. You're faithful to your husband. You're being ethical in your business dealings. Perhaps even taking some shots for that. Maybe having a sacrifice because of your moral stand in your business. You're being consistent in your tithe. You're witnessing to your neighbor. Everything is great. For all practical purposes, you are living out the sum of the law. Love your God and love your neighbor. All is well. Until all of a sudden, out of nowhere, maybe it's your job. Maybe your job security is called into question. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, you are stricken with an illness, a life-threatening illness. If not you, maybe it's your spouse, close friend, a loved one. Maybe you're rocking along and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, maybe a couple of words between you and your spouse, and the next thing you know, you're as distant as two people can be. No communication. Total misunderstanding between the two of you. It may be you wake up one day and you're utterly, totally abandoned by your child, rejected by your child, rejected by your spouse. Let's not be afraid to say maybe it's emotional. Let's not shy away from that. Maybe you're rocking along and life is great and you're on a high and you're on cloud nine, and then all of a sudden out of nowhere you are overwhelmed by a sense of anxiety. You're just overcome. You say there's so much to be done. There's so many things to handle. I didn't know I'd be like this at this stage in my life. I didn't know it was going to be so hard. I didn't know I'd have so many irons in the fire. And it makes you sad. Because life's not what you thought it would be. You become lethargic. You wonder if you even care about relationships. Maybe even that your closest relationship on this earth. You don't even care about getting back with them. You're cool toward them. Or maybe you're cool toward God. Depressed. Let's just use the word. Maybe you're depressed. Well, this morning, the church is moving along. They're moving along quite nicely. A short truce. When all of a sudden, out of nowhere, that counterattack of the enemy with fury. Look at verse 1. Herod the king stretched out his hand to harass some of the church. Verse 2. Then he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. Now we've seen the first Pentecost. We watched the first persecution. We witnessed the first martyr. And now we see the first apostle. The first apostle falls by the sword in this verse. The sword of Herod. Now Herod is not to be confused with Herod the Great, the one who was alive at the time, or the one who was Herod at the time of Christ's birth, the one who killed all the babies trying to wipe out Christ. At that time, he's not to be confused with Herod Philip the First, the one who had John the Baptist beheaded, the one who was Herod at the time of Christ's crucifixion. This is Herod Agrippa the First, born in 10 B.C. He reigned only 7 years, 37 A.D. to 44 A.D. We'll talk about, Lord willing, we'll see his death. His sudden death next week. What was his responsibility? What would Herod Agrippa the First want to be remembered for? What do you want to be your legacy, Herod? That I kept the Jews happy. And he was good at it. Very good at it. He honored the Jewish traditions. He moved the seat of the government from Caesarea to Jerusalem. He rebuilt the city walls. He offered sacrifices in the temple. Obviously, you can see why. He was loved by the Jewish leadership. He was one of them, so to speak. In fact, they even allowed Herod Agrippa I to read from the law during the Feast of Tabernacles. But it was all pragmatic. There wasn't a bit of it that was sincere. It was all politically driven. None of it was piously motivated. He didn't any more care about the Jewish faith than he did the Christian faith. All Herod cared about was number one. All he cared about was himself. That was his philosophy of life. Make all these people happy so they'll like me. That's what we see in verse 3. But he says, and because he saw that it pleased the Jew, what? That he had killed James. James was the brother of John. Took his head off. That's the literal meaning of fallen by the sword. Took James' head off. And then it's just to say to the Jewish leadership, you like that? You like the taste of James' blood? You like the smell of his blood? I can do better. I'll up the ante. I'll go for a bigger fish. The man himself, Peter. That's what the rest of verse 3 says. He proceeded further to seize Peter also. And then it adds this comment. Now it was during the days of unleavened bread. Verse 4, so when he had apprehended him, he put him in prison and delivered him to four squads of soldiers to keep him, intending to bring him before the people after Passover. Four squads of soldiers. Four groups of four men. 16 soldiers to guard one man. Is he that dangerous? Don't you think you're carrying this too far, Herod? 16 men for one man? Obviously, Peter was public enemy number one. And just something about that comment at the end of verse 3. That was during the days of unleavened bread. And then at the end of verse 4, intending to bring him before the people after Passover. Peter's life was safe as long as it was Passover. Because Herod didn't want to make the Jewish leadership upset. He wasn't going to do anything to disrupt those rules that surrounded those special Jewish days. So as long as it was Passover, Peter's safe. Had it not been Passover, Peter's head would have been cut off immediately. Saying to Herod, but saying to you and me as well, this is God's timetable. This isn't Herod's timetable. It's to say to Peter, it's to say to you and me that God's hand is in this. God had him in prison. And so here's Peter, this bold apostle. I'm sure you might look at the first point in the children's bulletin because I know it's in bold print written there for you. Here's this great preacher, the great healer, the one who is the raiser of the dead, chained with two chains, chained between two soldiers, waiting execution. Need I remind you, and again, this is for the children too, it's something you can actually do as I say this now, that Daniel found himself in the lion's den, didn't he? Shadrach and his friends in the fiery furnace. Joseph in the bottom of the well, finally in a dungeon. Jonah in the belly of a fish. Paul in a Roman dungeon. John Knox in the belly of a ship, a French warship, rowing for 2 years, chained in the galley of that ship. I wonder if you find yourself in the prison today. Now, this isn't really the application right now. This is almost a primer for what's coming. But you need to be thinking about it. Are you in the prison? Have you been in the prison? You know what it means to be in the prison? Do you know what it is to be chained to sin? To be chained to a miserable existence, a miserable life outside of Christ, or maybe in Christ? You know what it's like for God to put you in the prison. A prison of hardship, the pain, the suffering, heartache, depression, maybe. Sometimes even the most faithful of Christians, they'll find themselves in the most desperate situations. Sure, there are seasons of calm, seasons of rest, seasons of peace. Even God will even give us great success in our lives. But then very often, here comes the enemy. Here comes Satan with a counterattack, with fury. I think some of us wonder if rest and relaxation in the spiritual sense are exceptions to the rule. Often short-lived. It's tough being in the prison. If you're in the prison this morning, you're not alone. You may need to hear that. You're not alone, and we all know it is tough. It's very hard when Satan even put 16 men around you, 16 of his goons around you to guard you. It's very hard. So what do we do? What's our chief weapon in our war against the enemy? In one word, it's prayer. Fervent prayer. Ardent prayer. Look at verse 5. Peter was therefore kept in prison. And look down, because I want you to see this. But constant prayer was offered to God for him by the church. Constant prayer. You could translate it fervent or ardent prayer, but a good rendering is this constant prayer. It's a good rendering because the emphasis of the verb is the continuousness of the praying. It was ceaseless. They were praying for me and praying for him and praying for him. Same word used for Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. And so what you have are the weapons of the state. You have the weapons of power and prisons and soldiers. And then on the other hand, or I could say versus the power of the church. Prayer. Don't miss where the power is in prayer. The power is of this God. The most powerful being in the universe, the divine warrior, your creator God, this God responds to your prayers. Imagine that. That's the power. It's very powerful. That the primary cause of all things, the first cause, we say, the first cause of everything that happens in this world. That's God. He's the first cause of all things. You know, He actually uses secondary causes to bring about His end. You know what some of the secondary causes are? Your prayers. And it won't happen unless you pray. But because of my measly request before God, the God of the universe is moved to action. That's power. We say the power of prayer. It's not so much the power of prayer as it is the power of the one to whom we pray. It's very powerful because your little prayers, your little petitions that you may say, well, I'll just pass today, could change the history of the world. Very powerful. And that's what's happening in Mary's house. Those little band of believers are having a profound impact on what was going on in that prison cell. Look at verse 6. When Herod was about to bring him out, that night Peter was sleeping, bound with two chains between two soldiers. And the guards before the door were keeping the prisoner. What's Peter doing? He's sleeping. They're praying. Because they're praying, Peter is sleeping. A picture of complete trust, complete confidence in God. Peter would later write, as we said in our call to worship, Peter would be the one to later pen, cast all your anxiety on him. Why? Because he cares for you. Peter believed that. Peter is practicing that right now. I wonder if while Peter is chained to those guards, even in his sleep, if he wasn't rolling that verse over in his mind. God will take care of me. cast all my anxiety on him. And so he sleeps. You think you could sleep in that situation? I've talked about sleep before. I think you think I'm obsessed with good sleep. I like good sleep. Sleep is spiritual. It really is. It has an impact on every other part of your life. Just listen as I read from the Psalms. In Psalm 3, Lord, how they have increased who trouble me. Many are those who rise up against me. Many are they who say of me, there's no help for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield for me, my glory, and the one who lifts up my head. I cried to the Lord with my voice, and he heard me from his holy hill. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustained me. Psalm 4, verse 8, I will both lie down in peace and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. Proverbs 3, verse 24, when you lie down, you will not be afraid. Yes, you will lie down and your sleep will be sweet. Some of you are down. Some of you, when I mentioned earlier, when you have the heartache and the depression even in your life, for some of you that may be early in the morning. You make it fine through the day. For some of you, it may be you're fine through the day, but when the sun goes down, something just comes over you. Maybe even some of you younger people, you put the children to bed, and once they're in bed, something just comes over you. It's anxiety, it's worry, even depression. During the German bombing raids over London, there was an older woman in a neighborhood. In this particular neighborhood, she was known as a woman with a very calm demeanor. She was known as not having anxiety. She was steady. That's the way they described her. And one morning, this neighbor asked her how she had slept the night before, and she said, I slept beautifully. I went to bed early, and I never woke up. The reason she was asked the question was because they knew there would be raids that night. They said there will be air raids tonight. The lady couldn't believe it. Said, how do you sleep? How is it that you sleep so soundly, knowing that we could be attacked? And this is what she said. She said, well, God tells me in Psalm 121 that he never goes to sleep, but he watches over his children. And I love this. She said, so sister, if God is going to be up all night, there's no use in us both staying awake. There's just some simple, practical truth in that. Apparently, here it is, the middle of the night. Those believers were awake, but they were praying for Peter, and he's very much asleep. Why? Because James 5:16, the effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Are you praying? Do you know that's true? If you believe that's true, do you know that text is true? Are you praying? Are you spending time praying? Have you got prayer partners? Do you have somebody you call that you pray every week, perhaps every day? Are you praying as spouses? Are you praying with your families? You want to join our Thursday morning prayer group that prays and fasts one meal a week just to pray for the children in the church. We'd love for you to join us. Tuesday morning, the prayer group that meets there, do you know when they pray that that makes a difference in your lives, because that group gathers to pray. And other groups. There are other groups. Are you praying? Do you know it to be true? That marriage. You think that marriage has fallen apart. Do you know that marriage that has all but lost hope, that God, the power of God unleashed only through prayer, can save that marriage? Do you know that child, the one who's rebellious, the one who is wayward, the one who is always in serious trouble? Do you know that the power of God unleashed in prayer can bring that child to his senses? Whatever the situation, the most hardened sinner, the most impossible situation, the most hopeless circumstances can be healed and saved with the power of God in prayer. That's just the way of God, if you'll notice the third point. The ways of a devoted God. Now this account of the miracle is actually very detailed. The angel's instructions to Peter are exhausted. In verse 7, the angel suddenly appears, but he doesn't do his work in the dark. There's this heavenly light that illumines the cell, which tells us those soldiers were fast asleep as well because the light didn't awaken him. In verse 7 as well, the angel removes the chains. In verse 8, they're finally waking Peter up by striking him on the side, who is so passive, we learn in verse 9, he doesn't even know if this is real or not. He thinks it's a dream. And the angel tells him to gird himself, put on his sandals, put on his cloak. Verse 9, Peter does immediately what the angel tells him to do. In verse 10, they pass the two guard posts, and then there's this iron gate that opens automatically. You know, I studied that, and I guess it was either that day or the next day I went to Bruno's and was walking through those doors, and they just opened automatically. And it made me think that it may have been like that. You know, they're just walking toward those iron gates, and the doors just opened. It also made me think another practical way to pray, that every time I go to a store or something like that that has those kind of doors, perhaps it'll remind me God can open the doors. God can do in the life of that child or that marriage or that family or whomever. So it's a good way to remember to pray. The next thing we know in verse 10, the angel is gone. Peter in verse 11 realizes that it was indeed a miracle and that he himself is the object of the miracle. I think a side note question, why Peter? Why Peter and not James? Why didn't James have the same rescue? Sometimes all we can say, we don't know. We ask that question a lot. Why this one and not this one? Why me and not him and not her? Why? Sometimes all we can say is to the praise of the glory of God's grace. William Cowper did that. When he wrote that hymn, when he said this, God moves in mysterious ways. His wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Peter heads for the place where he knows he's going to find fellow believers. Look at verse 12. So when he had considered this, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark, where many were gathered together praying. Enter Rhoda. Rhoda is one of those individuals that you look forward to meeting in heaven one day. I think we would probably know a Rhoda, and we'd say, she's just funny. She's funny. And she did something in this text that you know the early church looked back on and just laughed and thought, can you believe she left him at the door? There they are praying, and the knock comes at the door, and everybody's wondering, what's Mary going to do? I mean, you've been in situations like that as well. In someone's home, you're deep in prayer, and the phone rings. And you sort of open one eye. You think, is she going to answer the phone? Is she going to let the answer machine get it? Who's going to get it? That's what's going on here. Who's going to answer the door? And Mary nods to Rhoda. And Rhoda gets up, and she goes to the door, and she hears Peter's voice. She can't believe it. She's so excited. She leaves him there. She runs back to the group, and they think she's crazy. And then when they finally realize, well, they say, well, maybe if she's not crazy, if she really hears his voice, maybe it's an angel. Sometimes it's just comforting to know that the early church, we put them on this pedestal. It's good to know they're as human as we are. They didn't anymore believe that their prayers were going to be answered than we do, right? Instead of saying, it is Peter, they argue. I wonder who it is. It certainly couldn't be Peter. He's in prison. They let him in. They make so much noise, they're going to give it away, give him away. He has to quiet them. He puts his hand up. Quiet. He hushes them. And in verse 17, motioning them with his hand to keep silent, he declared to them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. And he said, go tell these things to James. Now that's James, the brother of Jesus, not the one, obviously, who had been beheaded. This is the one who would soon be the head of the church in Jerusalem, that James. He says, tell him and the brethren. And he departed and went to another place. And then we find in the closing verses that the discovery that Peter was missing caused no small stir among the soldiers. All 16 of those men would pay for it with their lives. They would die. And we still wonder how God does this. Why does God allow these things? Even that. And we come away from it and we say, God has His ways. Praise be to God's glory. His wonderful grace. But brother, we know, you know as well as I do, that there are people, there are folk all over this sanctuary who are hurting. There are people in our church who need encouragement. We've got people in our church that don't even know if they're going to live or die. They're seriously ill. We have women in this church whose husbands one day just got up and left, abandoned them. We've got men in the same state. We have men in our churches, women, whose wives abandoned them. We've got people in our church with heart disease, tumors, there are malignancies. There is heartache. There's loneliness, rampant loneliness. Some who are struggling with children. They're struggling with addiction, alcoholism. Those that are afraid, those that are overwhelmed, even depressed. Do you know that Martin Luther suffered depression? It was devastating on even those around him. Very hard on his marriage. His wife's name was Catherine. He called her Kitty. And one day Kitty came in and dressed in all black. She was like she was going to a funeral. And Martin Luther said, "Who died?" And she said, "God did." And he said, "Kitty, how can you talk like that? You shouldn't say that." And she said, "I'm only dressed the way you live." As if to say, you're living as if God is dead. And we have people. We have people like that around us. That they live as if God is dead. Now, interestingly enough, when I was preparing this sermon, this was Monday, October the 2nd, and just so happens, by God's providence, that I was involved with a very close friend of mine who was very depressed. And I spent probably over an hour praying for this friend of mine. Absolutely overwhelmed. Overwhelmed at home, overwhelmed at work. You could say this person is in the ministry. They really are in the ministry. But I would say depressed. I would say that this friend of mine is depressed. And that he's known the joy of salvation, but he just doesn't know how to get the joy back. He's telling all these things. This is how you do it. This is what you need to do. He said, "I can't do it." He cries. He said, "I can't do it. I can't get back." And I have these situations. Why am I going through this on this particular day when I'm going to preach this sermon some weeks ahead? And I don't know. I never know the answer. I have to trust Him that I'm in that particular mood, even that day, or whatever's going on in my life. But I can safely say that, no doubt, I would preach this sermon today to say to someone in here, you're not alone. You're not alone in your pain. We all live in a fallen world. It's a very hard situation, hard world in which to live. I felt myself that I was being reminded through this passage that God can flood a world to deliver a Noah. God can send plagues on Egypt. He can part the Red Sea to save His chosen nation. He can send manna from heaven. He can send water from a rock. He can calm a storm. He can multiply loaves. He can heal the sick. He can give sight to the blind. He can give hearing to the deaf. And He can cause those chains to fall off your wrists. Right now, He can do that. Some years ago, and I'll close with this, but some years ago in a military high school for boys, the boys had taken over this rebellious part of the student body, had taken over the school, and they were making demands, and there was a standoff for days. As you can imagine, some of the parents were writing their children in the school and saying how disappointed, how ashamed they were, and how if they expel you from school, you're not coming home. There was one father that wrote a letter to his son. It's a true story. He wrote one sentence, three words, in fact. This shows the relationship this father had with his son. Three words: "Steady, son, steady." And I wonder if that's not even the very reason. I was taken back by the illustrations, and I thought, that's the text. That's what perhaps God wants me to say to you this morning. To some individual, as I get to know you, I love you more every day. I do. Beth and I were talking about it last night. I just love you more. But the thing is, I'm getting to know you better. And I'm beginning to see your hurts. And I'm beginning to see the pain you've lived with, some of you, for many years. And maybe today, maybe just on this Lord's Day, you need to hear your pastor say, steady. Steady, son, or steady, daughter. It's okay. And that's the message, really, is what, if you'll look at the top of the bulletin, this is the message. Long my imprisoned spirit lay, fast bound in sin and nature's night, thine eye diffused a quickening ray. I woke, the dungeon flamed with light. My chains fell off, my heart was free. I rose, went forth, and followed thee. I hope that's the anthem of your life. And I'm going to ask you to turn in your hymnal before I pray so that we have it open to hymn number 670. At the close of my prayer, if you'll notice in the bulletin, the choir will sing verses 1 and 2. We will join them, verses 3 and 4. We'll remain seated for the hymn. And then verse 5, we will sing without accompaniment. Again,